You're listening to English as a Second Language podcast, English Cafe, number 42. This is English as a Second Language podcast, English Cafe. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in the beautiful city of Los Angeles, California. On today's cafe, we're going to talk about online dating, people who find their romantic partner on the internet, talk about some popular services here in the United States for that. We're also going to talk about the most famous prize for writing in the United States, the Pulitzer Prize. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Remember to visit our website at eslpod.com for a complete transcript of this podcast. We provide an 8 to 10 page learning guide for every podcast that we do, and you can get the definitions and example sentences and cultural information, tips on learning English, lots of good things to help you with your English by going to our website. Now let's get started. Well, our first topic on the cafe today is an interesting one, I think. It's about online dating, people who find a romantic partner on the internet. Now, many years ago when I was much younger, back in the 1920s, there was a certain stigma about using the internet for dating. A stigma, S-T-I-G-M-A, it's a Greek word originally, and in English, it means that people don't think it's very nice. People think that there's something wrong with it. That expression, a stigma, is often connected with the verb attach. We say there's a stigma attached to online dating. It's like a bad reputation, a bad opinion that people have of it. But things have changed in the last 10 years, and now many people, especially in big cities like Los Angeles and New York, use these online dating services. There are many possible reasons why that is. Many people say that people today are not as close. The communities and families are not as close. So the opportunities to meet people for young people is not as great as it used to be. And so online dating is what we call the using the internet as a matchmaker. A matchmaker, M-A-T-C-H-M-A-K-E-R, all one word, is or was traditionally a person who helps find someone for you, a romantic partner for you. So I may know a friend of mine who's looking for a girlfriend, and I know a woman who's looking for a boyfriend. I introduce the two people. I'm a matchmaker. Now, in some places, the matchmaker is a professional, and you pay this person to help you meet other people. Well, the internet has become an electronic matchmaker for these online dating services. And there was an article in the Voice of America website about some of these dating services, and they're very sophisticated. That is, they use a lot of very complicated formulas. They ask people many different questions, and then they try to match your answers with answers that other people give. Many psychologists, professional psychologists, work with these companies to help them ask good questions and to figure out how to match people. It's a very, we would say it's a very lucrative business. Lucrative, L-U-C-R-A-T-I-V-E, is a business that you make a lot of money at. And because there are so many people who want to find love, who want to find romance, these companies make a lot of money. Usually, when you join one of these companies, you go onto their website and you fill out a survey. To fill out, F-I-L-L-OUT, means to complete. You put your answers in. How old you are, what's your height, what's your weight. Usually they'll ask for a picture. And then they'll ask you sometimes 200 or 300 questions about all the different things you may like or not like. And these questions you have to fill out first. You have to answer those questions. And then you send it to the computer, and then the computer tries to match you with someone. I don't know the exact cost. Most of these services, I think, charge you anywhere between $30 and $50 every month to use them. And there are millions of people who use these websites. One of the most popular here in the United States is called Match.com. M-A-T-C-H.com. And match, of course, as a verb, means to put two people, in this case, to put two people together, to put something together. And they have more than 15 million members in a couple of 100 different countries. It says in the article 240 different countries, and it is in 18 different languages. So Match.com is a worldwide operation, and you may have heard of it in your own country if you are not listening here in the United States. Well, according to Match.com, 60,000 people join every day. 60,000 people every day. And if you imagine each of those persons paying even $25 or $30, that's a very lucrative business. Well, the article that I got this information from interviews someone who uses the service, and she says that she was skeptical of meeting men on the internet. To be skeptical, S-K-E-P-T-I-C-A-L, means that you have doubts, that you're not sure, that you don't think this is a good idea, you're not exactly sure, you doubt something. She says she was skeptical because she prefers traditional dating, meaning places where you would find someone at a party or through a friend or perhaps at a bar. She goes on to say that at bars, you look at someone, you smile, you wink, but not much ever seems to come out of it. The expression you wink, W-I-N-K, means that you close one of your eyes quickly. You open and close it quickly. That's to wink, W-I-N-K. She says that you smile, you wink, but not much ever seems to come of it. The expression to come of here means to result in something. Nothing happens. And she's saying that she goes to bars and she may smile at a guy, and a man might smile at her, but that's it. Nothing happens. And the reason is because most men are afraid of asking women out on a date. They're afraid of asking them if they would like to go on a date for them. I know I was. And that is a problem that you don't have in internet dating. In internet dating, you find someone you're interested in. They're interested in you. You meet them. Of course, after you meet them, you may hate them and decide you don't want to see them again, but at least you had a chance to meet them. There are now what we would call specialty dating sites in the United States. Specialty, S-P-E-C-I-A-L-T-Y, is, you may guess, something that is for a specific or special interest. So one of these sites is called Date My Pet. Date My Pet, P-E-T, like your cat or your dog. And this is for people who like dogs and cats and want to date other people who like dogs and cats. That would not be a website I would use personally. There's also one called Grape Date, G-R-A-P-E-D-A-T-E. GrapeDate.com is for people who like wine. And there are others like this. Well, in addition to internet dating, there's also something that has become popular in the last 10 years, 15 years, called speed dating. Speed, S-P-E-E-D, dating. And speed dating is when you have two groups of people, usually men and women, let's say 10 in each group, and they come together for a couple of hours, and you get 5 or 10 minutes to talk to each person. And then after that, they ring a bell, and then you move to another person. So in one night, you get to talk to 10 or 15 people. There is a website called HurryDate, H-U-R-R-Y-D-A-T-E, HurryDate. To hurry means to go quickly, to go fast. And in the HurryDate website, you can pay $35 for an evening of 10-minute dates. So you get to talk to a woman or a man for 10 minutes, and then the person blows a whistle. They go, "All right, everybody, next person," and then you go to the next person. Sounds kind of crazy, but many people like it. It's a way of meeting other people. Some people think that 10 minutes is not enough time to really know whether you're interested in that person. I think that's probably true, but a lot of people, you are able to tell, you are able to understand very quickly whether you're going to like that person or not. In fact, there's an interesting book by a writer here who works for the magazine New Yorker, and he wrote a book called Blink, B-L-I-N-K. It's by Malcolm Gladwell, G-L-A-D-W-E-L-L. Very good writer in English, very clear writer. And his book is about how people are able to make decisions very quickly when they have just a little bit of information. Well, those are some ways that dating has changed in the United States. One of my best friends from high school met his wife on one of these dating services. They met, they dated for a couple of years, and they got married and now have two children. So sometimes it works. The second topic for today's cafe is the Pulitzer Prize for writing. This is the most famous prize in the United States for writing. Pulitzer is P-U-L-I-T-Z-E-R. There's an organization that gives these prizes every year, They have many different prizes. Some go to newspapers and magazines. They go to individual writers who do very good stories. Some of the awards go to people who write plays. And some of them go to people who write books, both literature, what we would call fiction, things that aren't true, as well as nonfiction, books that are about things that are true, like Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. And by the way, blink, I didn't explain, to blink is very similar to wink, B-L-I-N-K. To blink usually means to open and close both of your eyes at the same time. And wink is usually just one eye. Well, in either case, what we have in the Pulitzer Prizes is an award or some awards for writers. And if you look at a list of the Pulitzer Prizes, the Pulitzer Prize winners, especially in fiction and literature, you will see some of the best writers in the 20th century. This award began in 1917. So it's almost not quite 90 years old. And it's, as I say, considered the most important prize. If you write a book and it wins a Pulitzer Prize in the United States, everyone will know, or at least everyone who reads will know about your book. Some of the famous authors that have won the Pulitzer Prize in the United States, and it's for American writers or writers publishing in the United States. Let's see, some of the famous authors here. John Steinbeck won in 1940 for Grapes of Wrath, and that's a novel about people during the Great Depression. The Great Depression, D-E-P-R-E-S-S-I-O-N, is that time from the late 1920s until 1940-41, where the whole world had very difficult economic times. Many countries had many people who did not have jobs, who did not have work. And that novel, The Grapes of Wrath, is about the people who had difficulty during that time. Grapes, you know, is what you get wine from. And wrath, W-R-A-T-H, here means something like anger. When you are mad, your wrath is something bad you're going to do to someone else because you are angry. Other famous writers include Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway won in 1953 for his novel The Old Man and the Sea. It's a very short novel if you're looking for a short, not too difficult novel. That's a good one. Another famous writer is Harper Lee, L-E-E, and she wrote one great book called To Kill a Mockingbird. To Kill a Mockingbird. A mockingbird is a type of bird. And she won the prize in 1961. Her novel was later made into a movie, which was very famous in the United States. You may have seen it. It was it had Gregory Peck, P-E-C-K, a famous American actor. And it's about a lawyer in the southern United States who is trying to protect black people, African Americans, from people who are racist, people who don't like them because they are black. It's a very powerful story. It's a novel that many students read in high school. You might enjoy that book if you like reading in English, which I hope you do. because that's an excellent way to help you in your English. Some other readers in the last 25, or rather writers, some other writers in the last 25 years include Norman Mailer, M-A-I-L-E-R. He wrote a book called The Executioner's Song. The Executioner's Song, back in 1980. And executioner is E-X-E-C-U-T-I-O-N-E-R. An executioner is someone from, usually from the government, who is who kills people for who are prisoners, people who are supposed to die because they did something very wrong. Here in the United States, you may know that we still have the death penalty, the death, D-E-A-T-H, penalty, P-E-N-A-L-T-Y, says that if you commit a very serious crime, murder, you could be killed yourself. And the novel, The Executioner's Song, is about a famous case of that in the late 1970s. Many people, of course, don't like the death penalty. Many Americans are trying to stop the death penalty, but it is still here and in California and in Texas and in some other states. Every year there are some people who are executed, would be the verb. And that's a very powerful book, Norman Mailer's book. Another famous author is Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison won for a novel called Beloved. Beloved, B-E-L-O-V-E-D. And she's also a very good writer. So you can go on to the Google or your search engine and look for Pulitzer Prizes, and you will have there a list of some of the best books written in American English in the last 90 years or so. Now let's answer a few questions. Our first question comes from Rosella, R-O-S-E-L-L-A, Rosella from Italy. Rosella wants to know the meaning of the expression sitting duck. Sitting, S-I-T-T-I-N-G, duck, D-U-C-K. Well, a duck is an animal that lives in a lake, on a lake, a pond. It's a bird, and you can eat duck. Many people like to eat duck. You can hunt ducks in the United States. In some states, you can get a gun and go and kill a duck and take it home and eat it. I don't normally do that, but some people do, and it's popular in some states. The expression a sitting duck is actually comes originally from this idea of hunting ducks, going out to kill ducks. If you find a duck on a lake, sitting on a lake, and they do not, the ducks do not know that you are there, it's very easy to shoot them with a rifle, R-I-F-L-E. A rifle is a gun that you use to shoot when you are hunting. It's very easy to shoot the ducks. And you might call them sitting ducks because they're not trying to escape. They're not trying to leave. Usually that expression, sitting duck, refers to someone who is very easy to attack or someone who is very easy to hurt because they don't they're out in an area where they don't have any protection. So if you are a soldier, for example, in a war, and you are in the desert and you don't have a car or a tank or anything, and you are just there by yourself, and someone who doesn't like you, someone from the other side in the war, comes to you with a gun, you are a sitting duck. You don't have any defense. You are very easy to attack or to hurt. And that is an expression that we use for those sorts of situations. Someone is a sitting duck. When they're going to be hurt or something bad is going to happen to them because they are without any protection. Our next question comes from Brazil, from Beto, B-E-T-O. And his question has to do with pronunciation. His first question has to do with pronouncing words with an EA or EE in them and words with an I in them. He gives some examples here. The first one would be cheap, C-H-E-A-P, which means inexpensive, and chip, C-H-I-P, which could be a couple of things. A chip could be like a potato chip, a piece of baked or fried potato. Well, there isn't a good general rule. Normally, EA is pronounced E in words such as cheap and leap. The EE in the middle of the word is also usually pronounced E, what we would say a long E. So words like sheep or sleep, those are words that have that long E sound. If there's an I in the middle of a word, it could be either a long I or a short I. It depends on what else is in the word. For example, in the word chip, there's only one vowel, the I, and that is a short I. But if we were to put an E at the end of that word, C-H-I-P-E, that's not a real word, but as an example, we would probably pronounce that made-up word, that invented word, chipe, C-H-I-P-E. It's that E at the end, which you don't pronounce, makes the I a long I. An example of that for two real words would be strip, S-T-R-I-P, and stripe, S-T-R-I-P-E. The E at the end makes that I sound like a long I, so it's stry instead of stre, stripe and strip. Beto also has a question about the TH sound, which is difficult for some speakers of other languages. The difference between thank and tank. And he says he has a difficult time hearing the difference. And I agree, especially when people speak quickly in English, it is sometimes difficult to hear the H. But there is a difference. The TH sound in thank is made by putting your tongue in between your teeth, whereas the word tank, T-A-N-K, which is could be a big container, something you put water in, could be called a tank. A tank, the tongue is not in between the teeth, it's up on the top of your mouth. So thank and tank sometimes sound the same, but there is a difference between them. Next question now comes from China, and this is Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, in China. And the question has to do with the expression to cross your fingers, to cross, C-R-O-S-S, your fingers. To cross your fingers means to hope for or to wish for good luck or good fortune. I'm going to cross my fingers that I win the lottery. Notice we use the word that after the expression. Cross your fingers that we win means hope that we win. You should try to wish that we win. We use this expression in a couple of different ways. Someone can say, I have my fingers crossed, means I'm hoping for a good result. I'm hoping for luck. Or you can tell someone, cross your fingers, means hope that it will happen. You should hope that it will happen. So that is the expression, to cross. To cross, C-R-O-S-S, your fingers, means to put one finger in front of the other finger so that it is like an X, like the letter X. That's to cross your fingers. You can cross your legs also, and that's something you do when you sit down, particularly a woman who's wearing a dress will usually or often cross her legs, put one leg in front of the other. That's also an expression, but that does not mean good luck. It's just a way that someone decides to sit. Well, thank you, Bobby, for that question. That's all we have time for on this English Cafe. Be sure to visit our website at eslpod.com for more information about this podcast. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan. This podcast is copyright 2006 by the Center for Educational Development.